Brownmark Network episode, we will be having a conversation surrounding trauma and how cultural differences and traditions might affect the way we process that trauma. So joining us in our discussion today is Krishma Tuli Arora, who is the author of the book From Ash to Ashes, a coming-of-age story that follows Mira and her immigrant family as they grapple with the stark differences between their traditional Sikh faith and the changing culture of the world around them. So welcome, Krishma.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Can you just kind of jumping straight in, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your book, From Ash to Ashes?
Yeah, sure. I was born in India, in Chandigarh, and I moved here when I was like 4 and a half, almost 5 years old with my family. So I am an immigrant. And this book has been inspired by some true events in my own life. So very similar to the protagonist of my book, Mira, I am an immigrant. She also came at the age of 5. She also grappled with a lot of cultural differences when she moved here, moved to America in the book, as well as I did growing up here in Queens and then on Long Island, where the book takes place, actually. But I myself am also a graduate from NYU, and so is Mira, the protagonist in the story. But she deals with a lot of things, of course, which it's a fiction novel. A lot of people have asked me if it's, you know, true to my life. It's not. It is fiction. But there's definitely things, you know, that have inspired me to in my own life that I've brought up in the book. I'm a social studies teacher. I've taught high school social studies for about 11 years. I recently took a break because I had actually my fifth child, my daughter, who is now 16 months old, and she's the youngest. Now I have two boys and two girls, and my oldest is my son, who is 17. So, let's just put it this way. Our house is always a bit of a circus, and I have all these kids to keep me on my toes all the time.
That's amazing. And I don't know. I mean, I guess it just for your book specifically, can you just like, what are some themes that we can start kind of looking at, or like what themes are kind of resonate in the book as readers read through it?
Yeah, well, definitely there is the themes of the intergenerational gap between parents and their children, the general lack of communication amongst families, which is very predominant of South Asian culture, as well as the cultural gap between, you know, America and India, like the Asian world and the Western world. And then how you sort of bring your own, because India is so diverse, you know, in terms of religions, cultures, languages, the food, everything we do is so different. So there's different degrees, I find, depending on where you're from, in terms of how different it can, and how difficult it can be for immigrants to acculturate to American culture, and to what degree. I find that we're always somehow in a gray zone. You know, we're not fully Indian and we're not fully American, where we're always trying to balance somewhere in between. And how we reach that balance really depends on, you know, our upbringing and our families and their values and their value systems. So all of that is in the book.
Wow. Yeah. We can't wait to start reading it. For listeners, we also got a copy of the book. And so we'll most probably read through it and give it some of our thoughts after reading some of the chapters on Instagram. So you can check that out. But yeah, and I kind of, to talk a little bit about how you got started with the book itself, what made you decide to like write your story in like a book format? And how did you get started in trying to write, like put this into a book?
So the reason I started writing this story was because I lost my firstborn son almost 18 years ago. And at the time I was only 24 years old. At that time, now you're going back almost 20 years, like 19 years. Mental health definitely wasn't looked at the way it is today, at least not in South Asian culture. I think recently I've noticed there's a great awareness being brought to mental health, concerns in our culture. But if you rewind 19 years ago when I lost my son, to even want to seek a therapist was considered weird, strange. Like, why do you need that? You don't need that. You're not really depressed. Obviously, you've lost your child, so you're sad. This will pass. It takes time. Things will heal. And I really wasn't given the access to mental health care that I really desperately needed as a young mom who lost her child. And so I didn't really know where to turn. And I, at the time, I was also not living in New York near my family. I was living in the UK in Manchester, where my husband's family is from. I was living with his family. So I was even more isolated. And I didn't really know where to turn. And since I had always been a creative writer growing up, I sort of started writing the story as an outlet to channel my own emotions and my own grief, because I didn't know where to go and I didn't know who to talk to and what to do. So I started writing a story, an imaginative story about a family who loses their child. And in that sense, the book is very real for me, because a lot of the emotions that the mother goes through, when you see her grieving in the chapters, that was me, you know, not wanting to live, not wanting to enjoy anything, not wanting to continue. So that's why I started writing the book. It was a way to cope with loss and trauma.
I think that's amazing that you were able to kind of use your hobby or your passion for writing as an outlet of sorts to kind of come to terms with some of the stuff that you've had to deal with. As you have been, because, you know, it has been a very long time. You started this so long ago. As you write and as you kind of got through the thick of the book, has your emotions kind of evolved as you've written this? And how do you feel about it now that it's out, you know, or it's about to be out?
Well, yes. So I started writing when I was 24. I finished writing when I was 41. And the hardest thing was to do was to pick up these chapters I had written over the years on and off, because I moved countries, I had more children, I went back for a master's, and then I started teaching, and then I had more kids, and I was still working. So it was a lot to juggle. So that's another reason why it took me so long. But in a way, it's a blessing that it did, because what I saw was the girl who started writing at 24 turned into this woman, but, you know, along her 30s and then into her early 40s. And that's another reason why I left the book for so long, because I never knew or understood how to finish it until I turned 40. And I realized that I'm such a stronger woman now than I ever was. And this woman knew how to end the book. The first woman knew how to start the book, and the last one knew how to end it. And then the rest of it was to try to put it together seamlessly. So it wouldn't look like three different women were writing this book. But the other thing was that the writing helped me heal so much, because I dedicated the book to my son. So in a way, it was like a promise that I had made to him that kept pushing me along, saying that writing about this is going to make you feel better. It's going to give you clarity, and it did.
Yeah, that's really great. You kind of grew with the book, and yes, you were able to tell your story in the different phases of your life that you did as you kind of wrote along with it. Mm-hmm. I guess kind of diving a little bit into the themes of the book. So how do you, in your perspective, like, how might cultural traditions affect the way that we handle and process trauma? Could you go, I know we talked a little bit briefly before, but could you go a little bit more into it from your perspective?
Yeah. So there was a lot of criticism for wanting to process the trauma that I went through, like cultural criticism. I felt like in terms of culturally, I was sort of expected to, obviously, you know, cry and everything during the funeral. But once that was over, it was expected that now you have to move on. Now you have to have another child. You know, you can't grieve. Should you speak to strangers about, you know, family issues and what you're going through? It was sort of like a taboo to do that. Like, I was not really allowed to go speak to a therapist, because I think in our culture, your issues within your family are your family secrets. And to go out in the world and share it with someone who's a stranger is considered like bringing shame upon yourself and your family, and admitting that you have problems. Because, I mean, the way the South Asian culture works is that you should be acting like everything is perfect. Everybody's doing what they're supposed to be doing and all is working well. To admit that you might need medication to help yourself, to admit that depression is real and it has real physical symptoms are all things I fought against. Because I, you know, the idea was you know, what are you saying, that you have problems? You're mad? You're what? No, it's saying that I'm in a state where I can't actually physically help myself. So I need to ask someone else for help. And doing that somehow is just like against our cultural traditions. I don't know if, you know, I feel like that's still true to today in many families.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree. I think that that still definitely resonates with the community that exists now. And there has been a lot of kind of, we're kind of, like you said on the top of this episode, we are evolving into sort of more awareness of mental health issues. And, you know, even our parents are starting to kind of ask those questions now that they've lived here for so long. And they are also in that kind of crux between two different generations and how do you start, or two different cultures, and how do you kind of come to terms with that? So I think to your point, it is getting there, hopefully. I think in the next like 20, 30 years, I think it's going to slowly keep evolving and it's going to become more of a conversation that can happen, especially in terms of trauma and dealing with what life throws at you. I guess, like, I know the book itself was a huge kind of, I guess, a tool for you to process your trauma, but do you have any other sort of tools and strategies that you've kind of picked up along the way? And, you know, maybe if our listeners are kind of going through something, is there something that you would kind of give advice to them?
Yeah, sure. I would say that do something that makes you happy. Maybe you're a person who loves nature. You know, get outside, force yourself to go outside into nature. If you're somebody, you know, like if you're someone who is usually active or fit, go back and start exercising again. It releases endorphins, it, you know, feel good hormones. All these things really make a difference. Surround yourself with people who uplift you rather than people who criticize you, because the company you keep really determines how you feel about yourself. You know, people who are positive, they make you feel good about yourself. They make you feel supported. Whereas people who are critical are toxic because they sort of bring you down with them. So be mindful of who's around you and who you speak to. And then again, don't be ashamed to reach out for help. It's okay to talk to a social worker. I mean, it took me, you could say, 7 years after my son passed away to finally go see a social worker and accept help. And I was so much better for it. You know, I mean, I'm not saying that whatever has happened, I'm over it, because you're never over it. You just learn to live with trauma. But what I'm saying is that it finally allowed me to feel more at peace. And so go out there. Don't be ashamed, regardless of what anyone says. Seek the help that you need. Get the help that you need. And don't feel that, you know, oh, it's nothing. You know, validate your feelings. If you are feeling down, then understand that you are down and it's okay. And do something that makes you happy or that you enjoy. And stay away from things that don't, even if people think that's the right thing to do.
I think that's really, really true. Knowing when you need help and like asking for it is a really hard thing to do, especially in our community, like you've mentioned. In a past episode, one of our guests said that sometimes family is not really necessarily just blood family. You can define who your family is in time of when you need support. Yeah. I think that still really, really resonates, that like it's really helpful advice. But it's typically kind of hard in our community when you can't, like, you should connect with your blood relatives to get the support that you need. But I was wondering, when you were getting help for yourself, but was there a support system that you kind of went back to or tried to reach out to? And how did you kind of try to get that support or that circle that you need? Just maybe for listeners who are in a similar situation where they need to find a support system to get through some of the things that they're going through.
So, I mean, I don't want to say, but at that time, my husband was not a support. I wish he had been. In a way, the only support that he could really give was to finally say, fine, I'll allow you to see one if you want to, but like, I don't want to be involved in it. So I know there are a lot of women out there whose husbands don't support mental health because they've been brought up to not be open about their feelings and emotions, and something very hard for them to do. But where I did find support was from one of my old best friends from college, an old dorm roommate of mine. And, you know, we would keep in touch, and she was someone who I could talk to. And she was not Indian, of Indian descent. But, you know, we had that bond, an old bond. So she knew me well, and I felt like I could trust her and she could trust me. And so she was a great support, as well as just my general faith, I think, in God, and then the social worker. I mean, the social worker was a miracle worker. She, you know, made me feel very safe and made me realize that a lot of the things that were plaguing me were, I was sort of doing it to myself. You know, we do that with our thoughts. So definitely it was not blood related family at all. So unfortunately, you find support where you can. And even if it's just one person, I didn't have like five people supporting me. It was just one person. And that's all I needed.
Yeah, it's so true. And I think that's really great. You can find the support, like they weren't blood related, and reaching out, that's really great. I know one other aspect of the book that touches upon is also like the inevitable generational gap between like the parents and kids. And that can also lead to different types of trauma. Just kind of switching into that. I'm just curious, do you have any advice for how we could start bridging the gap from your perspective as a parent? And then kind of seeing how your kids grew up, or how your kids are growing up right now. Do you have any advice or kind of some of your perspective or experience in relation to that, like in terms of that generational gap?
Yeah, sure. So as a parent, I would say be open-minded, listen to your kids. And I find that a lot about South Asian parents, they have a lot to say and the things that they want to tell their kids about what they believe, about what their kids should be doing, how they should be behaving, where they should be at this point in their life. But what they're not doing is they're not listening to their kids. They're not really hearing them in terms of how they're feeling, where they want to go, what they want to achieve. And it needs to have an open dialogue, an open discussion. Parents need to do that, because what happens is if you keep forcing your children to repress their feelings, to repress their emotions, then it causes in a way for them to feel isolated from you. And then they're not able to communicate with you. They don't want to share. Then they start keeping secrets. A lot of them have secret lives, you know, from their parents, because, you know, they can't be open and honest. So having an open and honest relationship and dialogue with your kids is absolutely necessary. The advice I'd give to kids, like teenagers, because I have teenagers. I have teenagers and I have little ones, you know, so like all over the place. But I find is my teens come and tell me everything, and they're boys. Usually like boys don't even like talk generally, you know what I mean? Like girls can be a little bit more expressive, I find, but my boys tell me about everything, like about girls, about school, about this thing and that. And it's because And they're all night owls, but I'll find the time to sit there with them at night in my pajamas and sort of like recap, like, oh, what's going on? What's up with this? Oh, that teacher, that coach, that, because you need to make them feel that you're connected. That connectedness is a very important bond that, that you can make. But the kids, I say to the kids, please be open to your parents. Like if you're on your TikTok and you're on your chatting on Snap with your friends, but now your parent is here, give them that time because, you know, this is a good opportunity for you to say what you want to say and be heard. And, you know, so that even your parent feels comfortable talking to you. There are some parents who are a little bit more conservative than others. Like I'll talk to my boys about girls, no problem. You know what I mean? But I know some parents won't. So maybe if you, as kids, make your parents feel comfortable, eventually they'll be open to having the more uncomfortable conversations with you. So.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I know Sneha and I, we both have that similar dynamic with our parents too. It's very open-minded. Like it's okay to talk about it first rather than like try to keep it to yourself and try to figure it out and get mm-hmm. to a situation where you need to, you think that you're alone when you're really not. Right. So I definitely agree with you. And I hope that kind of shifts more as like we get, I feel like that will, as we kind of get more generations of South Asian Americans of having that kind mm-hmm. of open communication. Mm-hmm. But yeah, with that, something that came out of my mind is I know this book is a personal reflection in some sorts of way for you. And you've mentioned that just out of curiosity, when your kids and family read this book, what do you hope that they would get out of this or like what they hope to see about you through this book? Because I know your husband most probably went through his own grief process with your son.
Yes.
And your kids most probably have a different perspective or experience with it. So I guess what do you kind of hope that they get out of this book when they read it?
That's actually a great question. And I hope that they see that their mother is someone who believes that no matter what happens in life, that you can, like through perseverance, you can overcome many challenges and obstacles and still, regardless of anything else, still love life, you know, still live life to the fullest, still value every moment of whatever life brings you. Because good or bad, life and the human condition needs to be celebrated because that is the beauty of our life. I mean, life wouldn't be what it is if everything was always perfect and everything was always good. It's the learning process. It's the growth that we make as human beings, as people, which is miraculous in its own way. And so I want them to see that regardless of what life might bring their way, because they're still kids. So life's like, I mean, they have their own challenges and all, but, you know, as they get older, life may bring other challenges, bigger obstacles. How are they going to face it? You know, are they going to turn into alcohol abuse like one of the characters in my book does? Or are they going to turn to spiritual guidance as the protagonist does? Where will they find their strength of character that will build them and their life? So that is definitely something I want them to take away from it, that, you know, that your mother was someone who believes in perseverance and always looking on the bright side and the positive side of life.
That's awesome. And I think I assume that that's exactly what they're going to get from your book. I have such high expectations. I'm so excited to read it. And I was going to, I guess kind of tailing off of that, are you like in any way like nervous to kind of, you know, share this to the world? Or is there any sort of, can you talk? I can't even imagine what it must feel like to finally kind of put this out there and have your family and everyone read it.
Well, it's very exciting. But at the same time, I'm very nervous because at the end of the day, you know, every vulnerability of you as a person and as a writer is in this book. And people, you know, or it can be very judgmental and very critical. And sometimes it's very hard to put your real and inner self out there, to open to judgment and criticism. But at the end of the day, the story is true to myself and, you know, what I've learned, and it's taken me many, many years to finally understand it, is that it doesn't matter what other people think and what other people say. You have to live your life according to your truth. And that's all I can do. And I hope, you know, no one is offended by it. It was hilarious that you said that, because my husband the other day said, he said, but everyone's going to think that I did this. I'm like, you're not him. I'm like, I know you want to be the lover boy in the story, but it's not you. That's awesome. So, you know, so that's why I keep saying it's still a fiction.
Right, right. I mean, I guess kind of going into that a little bit, like, you know, you talk about, you know, in addition to the generational gap between the characters in your book, I think there's also this kind of, you know, your book touches on the pressures of preserving one's own culture, right? So specifically, yes, for Mira's parents, how do you preserve your Sikh kind of roots and also live in a world that's completely different from that? Mm-hmm. So I mean, I guess I will ask you, how have you defined what parts of Sikh culture you keep in your life and which parts don't really resonate with you anymore?
Well, what I love about my religion is that there's a fundamental belief in oneness, and oneness in different sense of the word. Oneness definitely in terms of we are one humanity. So to discriminate against each other based on our class, based on our race, our, you know, our wealth, our status, whatever it is just wrong. And so I love that part. And you see that part in the book too. And then there's this oneness of Sikh philosophy, which I follow closely and dearly, is the idea that the universe is also one. We are one with the universe. And that was a part of the Sikh religion that helped me cope with my loss, actually. Because if you look out into nature, you see that everything in the universe is pretty much cyclical, right? So, like, you know, in terms of the weather, in terms of everything, has a cyclical nature. And in my belief, I believe in karma, I believe in reincarnation. And I feel like the essence of our spirit, the essence of God's spirit and the universe, is cyclical. So I feel like, although my son, you know, physically passed away, I feel that his spirit lives on, and it doesn't just die. It goes somewhere else, and it's his force. It's an energy force. It goes into another form. And that in itself has always helped me cope too. So there's, you know, Sikh philosophy resonates with me today, 100%. In terms of other things, you know, there are some rituals and some beliefs about Sikhism which have evolved, that have evolved within me from the time that I was a teenager, and, you know, things about keeping one's hair long, and my boys decided a few years ago when they were, I mean, they're still teenagers, but when they were a little bit younger, that they wanted to cut their hair. And that was like a very big family decision, especially for myself. But then I sort of had to go back to my spirituality, which told me in Sikhism that at the end of the day, you know, the what's more important than the physical attributes, it's the spiritual, right? It's the oneness, going back to that oneness. So in a way, there are certain things I've abandoned, and then there's certain things that I keep on.
Yeah, and kind of going off of that, I know, like, when we're talking about the parents' expectation to kind of bring pass down the culture and ensure it doesn't get diluted in some form, right. These aspects that you mentioned that you really hold dear to you about Sikhism, how do you hope to kind of share that with your kids, and like how your kids might practice or take it to how they want to build their own like character?
Mm-hmm. Well, so my oldest son, because he's 17, and since 13 or 14, We have always had philosophical discussions. So, you know, he knows where I stand, and he takes a very existentialist point of view. I think more, not that he fully believes it, but I think more to be the devil's advocate. So we have these great, you know, like arguments and discussions about stuff. So I know he's thinking along those lines. I know there's this spiritual foundation within him that when he's ready and when he's an adult and he's decided what he's going to believe in, he's going to believe in something. Do I want him to believe in the philosophy that I believe in and I've passed on to him? Okay, maybe. But it doesn't matter. As long as he has a belief system that helps him to cope within life, that's the most important thing. Now, the other children are a bit younger. All of this is very deep for them. So, but, you know, for example, I'll tell you, my daughter, my other daughter, who's 7 years old, you know, she sleeps in her room by herself and she feels afraid at night, like as little 7-year-olds, you know, do. And so she doesn't want me to leave her. And then so what I tell her is, you know, I've taught you the mantras, the first of the prayers. And when you feel afraid, just know that you can always pray for protection, you know, and pray for feeling calm and peace. And so you feel protected this way. And then I put on some different hymns in her, hymn, like in the room on the speaker for her to listen to as she falls asleep. So it's in a way to teach them how to cope, how to self-cope, what to do when you're afraid, what to do when you feel, when you're not confident, some sort of spirituality, and also just general things, you know, which is part of Sikhism, but also part of many other religions. Just be a good person. Don't lie. Don't cheat. Be honest. Be good with people. Don't be jealous. If you feel jealous, let's reflect. Why are we feeling jealous? You know, it's okay. We can't always have what others have, and that's fine. And just be happy with what you have. Be grateful every day about something that you have. You know, look around at other children who are without food, without clothes, who are suffering, you know, rather than complain about, oh, I'm bored or I have to go to school. You know what I mean? So there's always those aspects too of keeping your religion, your culture, your values, just generally even just being a good person is the most important thing.
Yeah, that's great that you have that type of communication with your kids, because I think that's the most easiest way to, like, kind of share what you want with your kids without, mm-hmm. like, the typical way where we kind of see, like, the stereotypicals, like, you should do this because I tell you to. Yeah. Or, and people ask why, and you're just like, I just because you have to do it. That's our tradition. And you're just like, well, why? So I definitely think that, like, that's a really great way, because I think it makes it more receptive. And the idea of making whatever you take, whatever you want from our culture, our religion and traditions, to make it how it'll benefit you and keep you going, I think that's super important. Yeah. But kind of, because we do have, we're at the end of our episode, just want to dive a little bit quickly into, like, your writing experience and your writing okay. career. Can you talk a little bit about how you got started professionally writing and how you got some of the opportunities that you might have gotten before you had started writing your book?
I used to write, when I was a teenager, I used to write for the Sikh magazine that my dad used to circulate, actually. He used to circulate it in Gurdwaras, like local Gurdwaras, all the way up to New Jersey too, like New York, New Jersey. And I used to write articles for it. While I think I was a teenager, and then when I was at NYU and I write articles on the side, I would research a lot, read a lot. I did have a mentor too, who taught me a great deal. And so whatever knowledge I had, I would write about it. And then later on, I moved away. I changed careers. I was in a marketing career. Then I went into, when my boys were little, they were like 5 years old and 3 years old, I went back and I got my master's in education. Then I began teaching. And then I just started writing poetry in my free time, something that I used to do when I was younger too. So when I was younger, I used to submit my poems, you know, to this national contest and things like that. I used to do a lot of that kind of stuff. So I always had writing, you know, as part of me. And then I started writing for a local magazine called Brookville Living. on Long Island, where I live. And they allowed me to have my own column, which was great, because now I could, it was called Free Spirit. That was the name of the column. And in Free Spirit, I would basically sort of add a dose of spirituality every month to the magazine. And it was basically things like, I had an article once called like how to live your life outside the box, you know, or I had articles about the seasons changing and like the cyclical nature of the universe in our life. Like some were very deep and philosophical and some were like more lighthearted, you know, about Mother's Day, you know, your relationship with your children as a parent and parenting things. And then once in a while I'd submit my poetry in there too. So I did a bit of that. And then, but I had my book all along, all those years too, that I was writing on and off. But this is the first you can say I've had smaller publications, but this would probably be my main and my biggest project. Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. And I guess as a final question, bringing it all back to your book, Ash to Ashes, can you just kind of, who are you trying to target in terms of audience for this book, and how, what would you tell them? What would you tell them to try to get them to read this book?
Well, I think that the target audience would be anyone who could resonate with having a difficult time communicating with their parents or the older generation, you know, B, someone who feels like they're grappling with two different cultures and finding themselves lost within two different cultures. You don't have to be South Asian and, you know, American. You could be, you know, it could be two other different cultures, but it's the same type of experience. Somebody who is, part of that also, I want to give a little sneak peek, is also part of interracial marriages is also a topic that's big in the book. And oftentimes the whole stigma behind interreligious marriages and intercultural marriages, you could say, and how it's still a taboo. I mean, it's so much more open than it used to be, but it's still something, you know, that is not considered favorable, at least not in South Asian culture. So that's a big aspect of the book too. And what you see is what it does to the characters as a result. Also, loss and trauma. Anyone who has faced loss or has been struggling with grief, this book will definitely resonate with them. And of course, it is a coming of age story. The main character is 18 years old for most of the book. I don't want to give it away, but you know, there is a sneak peek into her future later on. But for most of the book, she's a young girl. And so anybody who is a teenager, is a young adult, this book could, you know, would resonate with them too. So I feel like there's a lot there. Anyone with a family, it would resonate with, because it's a lot about family conflict. There's a lot of themes in here. Anyone who loves spirituality, there's a spiritual side in the book too. So I think my audience is everyone, because I think as people, we all face these things, right?
That's so exciting. And I'm very excited. Me and Kirthi both, I don't want to speak for Kirthi, obviously, but I'm very excited to read this book and experience it. And I'm so excited. With that, we will conclude this episode of Brown Art Network. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Thank you, Krishma, for coming on. Krishma's book, From Ash to Ashes, will be out on May 23rd of this year. So please go check it out. And it's also now available to pre-order. So we'll put that link in the description, as well as a link to your website. Krishma, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure being here.
Thanks again for listening to this episode of Brown Art Network. We hope you enjoyed hearing all the wonderful conversations we had today. Go check us out on Instagram at RedefiningABCD and feel free to let us know your thoughts on this episode. And as always, if you know anyone who'd be interested in being interviewed for a future Brown Art Network segment, either direct message us on Instagram or email us at redefiningabcd@gmail.com. Stay safe and happy. We'll see you all in the next one.